The 1999 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session 114, Complicity and the Limits of Forgiveness by David Barber, with comments by Brad Woodworth.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's time for us to begin this first Sunstone Symposium feature of Thursday, July 15th, 1999. We're happy to greet you, and we're happy also to greet the audience who will listen to the recordings of this event. We welcome two young intellectuals of the Mormon faith and experience, and we are glad to hear what they have to tell us today. Now, particularly, our speaker is David Barber. He is a graduate of Brigham Young University. He's entering the University of Maryland at College Park this fall, and there doing graduate work, seeking his Ph.D. in the field of philosophy. And while at BYU, David was the religion editor of the Student Review. He had an interesting article published in the BYU Philosophy Journal called Aporia in 1997, entitled Plato's Arguments on the Inconsistency of Relativism. And I suggest to you that if we have time today after this feature's left, we might even want to talk to David about that article or have him tell us about that. David is from Albuquerque, New Mexico. Grew up in Albuquerque. He's from a family of five, and the rest of the family is in, I suppose, in Albuquerque at this moment, unless somebody slipped in here that is part of the family. That not being the case, we'll proceed now, and then we will ask Mr. Woodworth, who you have listed in the program. Did I say that right?
Yes.
Brad, who is going to give the customary response. And then we will open this meeting to questions and answers. And what we'd like to suggest is that for any questions you have, we would like to have you come forward, actually, and speak directly into the mic. I think that's better than having you ask the questions directly from the audience and then having me repeat them, which might not come across accurately. And so the question can be made directly, and the answer can be made directly. I now give you proudly David Barber. Thank you very much. Let's welcome David.
Thank you, Burton. Great. I've been a little busy putting together the symposium, so the paper is in an outline form, so bear with me. It's the first time I've given a philosophy paper that wasn't all written out. I started thinking about complicity when I was at BYU, and I was actually... this is just some background of the paper, and it doesn't really affect the paper, but now this, you'll know where I'm coming from in this paper a little bit. I was with the Student Review, and in that capacity investigated some things that some people at BYU were doing that I thought were wrong. Some actions by the administration, and I thought, these are clearly wrong. You've probably read about some of these in the press. And I could identify, I guess, a few people who made decisions that I thought led to these wrong actions. or people I, so I could identify people who were committing wrong, I would say. But there were a lot of people who went along with it. And as often is the case in moral reasoning, we first see flaws, moral flaws, in other people rather than in ourselves. And so I thought, oh, well, clearly these people are complicit. So those who could have spoken out but didn't, that type of thing. And so I'm not thinking, well, I'm not complicit in this, I was thinking, but these other people are complicit. So I started wondering about the question of complicity. But the more I thought about it, I started to see that that all of us are complicit in many things, and that will be developed in my paper. And so what's in the background of this paper is not just a few firings at BYU, but in fact, wrongs. I began to think of it in terms of political and social wrongs that happen throughout the world and that we all participate in to some degree or another. And that's really what's in the background of this paper. The interesting thing about the word complicity is that it can mean both an actual culpability and the feeling or awareness of that culpability. So it's like the word guilt. That's why I don't use the word guilt in defining complicity, because guilt also has this bifurcated meaning. We can say, well, I feel guilt, or I am guilty. So we can say that I feel culpability or I have culpability in whatever moral sense you want to apply that term. Complicity is similar. We feel complicity, but we also are complicit. We can talk about complicity in a couple of senses, and these are rough definitions. Strong complicity is when the individual has participated in a minor way in the wrong act of a group to which that individual belongs. But complicity doesn't mean, on the far end, the really strong end of complicity, it stops being complicity. It doesn't mean the even stronger culpability that comes from leading, directing, instigating, or being one of the major players in the group's wrong action. So we can think of, say, Nazi Germany, and we can think, well, certain people in Nazi Germany planned and executed horrible crimes. Others played major parts in those horrible crimes. But at a certain level, as we were assigning guilt, however we want to assign it, you come to the people who were complicit, who participated in a minor way in the wrong. And I'd say that's the strong sense of complicity. Now, getting even weaker in talking about complicity, the weaker sense is when an individual is merely a member of a community that does something wrong, the community does something wrong, but the individual does not participate directly in that wrong act. So the weakly complicit individual allows the action or does not speak against the action or does nothing to mitigate the wrong, but doesn't participate in the wrong. I think I would still like to say that that individual is complicit, and I hope you would agree that that's a fair application of the term. And if you don't, please object at the end. Well, let's talk about an example. We'll talk about, say, a German citizen in World War II who sees Jews being deported and doesn't say anything. That would be complicity in this loosely defined weak sense. I would think we would want to call that person complicit. There are many degrees of complicity, as I think you might have a sense of. One person might provide minor aid in committing the group wrong, so they may operate the trains that ship the Jews to the gas chambers. Another may be in favor of the wrong, though she says nothing for or against. So just kind of silently is in favor of the wrong. Another may be against the wrong, but does nothing as well. Still another may be against the wrong and even take some action to prevent or mitigate it, but still feel that she could have done more. we can certainly mitigate our complicity in an action. And it's I don't know how to say when we have done enough, hidden enough Jews in our attic to mitigate the wrong that we commit as an operator of the train to Auschwitz. It's a complicated moral calculus, and I think it can't be precise. The intermediate cases that I just ran through briefly make talk about strong and weak complicity in a rigorous way actually fairly useless. But I wanted to give you a sense of the area of area that we are going to call complicity, and it has kind of fuzzy boundaries. So now, let's see. Consider how you got here this morning. Most likely you drove a car. Cars are produced by car manufacturing corporations. Some of these corporations pay union wages, others do not. All of the domestic manufacturers are now engaged in outsourcing parts of production to cheaper labor markets in Latin America and Asia, thus cutting union jobs in America. This outsourcing also often takes advantage of lax environmental regulations in developing countries. Thus, it hurts not only workers, but the environment that we all share. So we see some economic wrongs being committed there, and we see some environmental wrongs. The car you drive runs on gasoline. The injustices perpetuated by oil companies, are many, from environmental depredation to the abuse of human rights and democracy in countries such as Nigeria. Your demand for gasoline keeps these companies in business and gives them incentive to engage in even more ruthless business practices and mergers and despoiling wilderness and et cetera. As you drive, your car contributes to localized air pollution and the buildup of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. The point of that little example is I think that we're all caught in a web of complicity in global social and economic wrongs. History gives a seemingly endless list of injustices in which many of us were or are in some way complicit. The oppression of Native Americans, African Americans, other ethnic minorities, women, homosexuals, political dissidents, the despoliation of vast tracts of land and bodies of water for human profit, the creation of the neo-colonial system of American global economic domination, and the wars that are fought to support this system, the vast and widening gulf between rich and poor in this country, the even vaster gulf between rich and poor in the world. I hope that's enough to make my point, the first point, that we are all caught in complicity by the way that we live our lives. As Americans, I don't know the statistic, but the average American consumes a huge percentage of a much greater percentage of global resources and pollutes much more and uses much more energy than the average Brazilian or even Belgian. But even the Belgians use a lot of electricity and go ahead.
Are you taking questions if you don't?
Yeah, why not? Sure.
You say we're complicit by the way we live.
Yes. I agree. I agree, and I hope we'll get to that same point.
The atonement was designed to
do. Yeah, we'll see if it can.
If we're going to take questions from the audience, then we'll have to have those questions either repeated here. Or we would, at the outset, we invited you to come up to either the microphones and ask those questions.
Okay, I'll try to.
But I would mostly encourage that the questions be left until the question and answer period.
So Gene's question was, he thinks that we're complicit just by living, not just the way we live, and I agree. and we'll get to that. And we'll see if the atonement can take care of that original sin. Let's take now a brief digression into what I used to call pop metaphysics, but is actually more accurately called folk metaphysics. You buy gas from Chevron and are thus complicit in the murder of a Nigerian activist. Chevron gets a lot of gas from Nigeria, and they've killed people who are protesting that sort of thing. But how many people are also complicit? Many millions to a small degree, right? A lot of us buy gas from Chevron. Guilt or sin is thought to have a certain metaphysical weight. Here is the folk metaphysics. We think, you know, in a metaphorical way, in a metaphysical way, we're weighed down by guilt or sin. What is the weight of the murder of one activist? It is certainly quite great. I think we would agree. But distribute this weight among millions of people, and it will amount to a milligram or two for each of them, and hardly enough to even bother about. And if we don't like that alternative, we can insist that the weight is so great that even distributed it is noticeable. So we say, well, we want each person to have, a few ounces of this weight, and so we add that up for the millions who are complicit, and then there's this tremendous weight that this murder carries. But this weight seems too great to realistically attribute to one murder. After all, lots of murders go on, and it's a horrible crime, but I think we'd agree it's not the worst, absolute worst thing that could happen. So we may want to go with that alternative. Or you can say that the weight is infinite, the weight of the sin of this murder. In that case, we are all sinking under the infinite weight of many murders, a weight that does not lessen as it is spread among the millions complicit in this crime. Right? As we divide an infinite weight, each person gets an infinite weight. So that way doesn't seem satisfactory either. We get into trouble talking about this too literally, I think. That was a digression. Now we'll come back. I think we all know that we are complicit in a lot of wrongs. The psychological tendency is then to shrink from the feeling of complicity, to hide from it in some way, by ignoring it, by rationalizing it away. We seek somehow to mitigate the evil that is done with our consent. We can do this either by actually working to lessen the evil or to compensate, for it with good, or by simply pretending that the evil is lessened or compensated for. Either method satisfies our conscience. The second method, a form of self-deception, is certainly easier. It's a lot easier to do nothing and ignore the complicity somehow than to work to lessen it. It would seem, then, that an important function of the moral calculus, however we want to run that, is to determine when our efforts are actually mitigating the evil in which we are complicit and when we are simply deceiving ourselves by pretending that the evil is mitigated when it really is not. A corollary project is determining to what extent an evil must be mitigated before we can rightly say that we are absolved of complicity in it. And as I think I mentioned, I don't know, I'm not going to attempt to determine that. It's very complicated. Excuse me. One way we like to avoid the feeling of complicity is by repenting of complicity. This repentance doesn't include removing ourselves from the social systems that ensnare us in complicity. So it doesn't involve ending the complicity, the actual complicity, not the feeling of complicity. It just means going through some mental anguish over the complicity or assuring ourselves that we are really righteous or progressive at heart or whatever, and thus aren't really part of the problem. For instance, we keep driving our car, our sport utility vehicle, but we inwardly deplore the waste of natural resources. And because we are progressive environmentalists, then we don't have to deal with the complicity that we have from driving this massive car down the road to work 20 miles each day alone. Clearly, this doesn't remove whatever actual culpability we have. It is merely a way of avoiding the feeling of culpability, the feeling of complicity. Putting this into religious terms, which I'm going to use metaphorically, or as a metaphor, I'm not going to get into whether this is not a doctrinal exposition. It's a philosophical exercise. Putting this into religious terms, what are we to make of the promise of the atonement to cleanse a person from all sin? I guess, Jean, I haven't gotten to the part where I say I think we're all complicit from the way we live. Here's why I agree with you on that, and then we'll go into this. We can't withdraw from all social relationships. And I think it's part of the human condition that wrongs are committed when we form groups by individuals. We can call it our fallen nature. We can call it something that is just given in being human. But in human relationships, wrongs occur. We can't withdraw from those. Or if we can, if it were possible to completely withdraw from all social relationships and all social obligations that we have as human beings, I think that would require becoming something other than human. So I agree that by simply living, by simply being human, we are complicit. So does the atonement, is the atonement able to cleanse a person from all sin, including the sin that accrues in us from complicity? If God were to forgive complicity when a person merely feels anguish for the complicity, but doesn't disentangle herself from it, so drives her SUV and feels guilty about it and anguish and prays for forgiveness, God would then, if God were to forgive her, he would then be removing the impetus for change, which is this feeling of culpability, before any change has been made. He would be promoting, by this forgiveness, continued wrongdoing. We assume that God doesn't promote wrongdoing. Thus, the atonement can't do away with complicity, or at least not with the feeling of complicity. Now, here's an odd thing. You know, maybe God can forgive a person, but not let the person know that they're forgiven, so that they continue feeling the complicity and work for change, which I think God would want. But when it's all worked, when it's all tallied up in the end, that guilt doesn't. Isn't on that person's account or whatever. That's a possibility, and that's fine. But then wouldn't this argument apply to all forms of sin, not just complicity? That is, in forgiving someone for any sort of sin, wouldn't God be encouraging further sin? Now, I've argued that God's not going to forgive complicity because that's encouraging continued wrongdoing and putting a roadblock in this person's path of reform and righteous doing. But doesn't that apply then to all forms of sin, individual sins that a person just commits, wrongs that the person does? This can go two ways. Pick one. Number one, maybe God can't forgive any sin unless the sinner forsakes it and makes restitution for it. That solves this problem. Then we would say, yes, this argument applies to all forms of sin. If a person is sinning and keeps on sinning but prays for repentance or seeks forgiveness, God can't forgive it. We could say that. There is a large streak of this sort of thinking in Mormonism. There's a large tradition of this. And that's, from that book, The Miracle of Forgiveness, I think there's quite a large streak of this. So we can go with that. That's fine. Number two, however, it seems that the story of the woman taken in adultery, among other New Testament stories, shows that God doesn't require forsaking the sin before granting forgiveness. In this case, the argument about not forgiving complicity still doesn't apply, since forgiving someone of an active sin or wrongdoing, so an ongoing sin or wrongdoing, can lead to the person's freedom from that sin. In other words, be an incentive to reform, So a forgiveness, God, we can imagine God using forgiveness as a way of showing a person the way toward a better life. While forgiving someone of complicity doesn't free the person from the social interactions that create that complicity, but does remove any incentive for the person to work to reform these conditions. So I'm still going to insist that God's not going to do that if we're going to argue that God is someone who doesn't want to promote wrongdoing. Now, I suggest that complicity comes about as a social, as the result of involvement in social relations. And I think it's fair to say that complicity is unavoidable for human beings. Here we are. Enmeshed as we are in social relations that fall short of whatever sort of moral ideal we believe in. Now, here's a little interesting exercise. Consider Jesus. He functions in moral discussions as sort of an asymptote. Is that the right term? A completely morally perfect, completely just human being, an ideal of perfection that we can maybe move toward but never approach, never link up with. We can never be that morally perfect, right? And in the narrative of his life, he commits no sins. I think we'll grant that. But was he free of complicity? Not likely. However progressive and radical we say his actions were, he still acquiesced in many things that went on in his society that we would call wrong. He was in some sense complicit, although we might want to say that the good he did outweighed his complicity in, say, the oppressive Roman rule in Judea. But then we would probably want to say this of a lot of people, that the good they've done in the world outweighs their complicity, or at least, you know, we can think of people like Gandhi or Martin Luther King, and say they did a lot of good, and that outweighs their complicity. But it doesn't take away their enmeshment in complicity. So if we're going to say that complicity is a result of the fall, is some sort of original sin that is part of being human, I think we're going to have to say that Jesus also was enmeshed in this by virtue of his being human. So it turns out that we've been talking about complicity all this time. The way we've been talking about complicity all this time has assumed an extremely high moral ideal, an ideal that even Jesus didn't live up to, which is really astonishing. And awareness of this complicity is useful in prodding us to reform our interpersonal relationships and the communities and society that we belong to. We should also wonder whether an ideal of goodness or of justice that condemns everyone is a useful ideal of goodness or justice. I think this is where what I gave you ended, right? Yeah. But it goes on. This is all new to Brad.
I'm sorry.
No, Brad's a respondent. Yeah. Okay. The problem here is that if we define justice and injustice, good and evil, in terms that make us take seriously our complicity in the evils of the world, we end up defining everyone as wrongdoers, as unjust. Not just that, but living a just life becomes in fact impossible, since it would involve extricating ourselves from all social relationships. So this goal is not just impossible, but undesirable. We don't want to extricate ourselves from all social relationships. That, I think, we would agree, not absolutely everyone, but hopefully we can agree that we should be involved in social relationships. That's a part of doing good. It's a part of living a good life. Undesirable to live a completely just life? Yes, by these definitions. But the alternative ways of defining justice or goodness, without throwing them out altogether, are again a way to flee the responsibility that comes with acknowledging our own complicities. So if we define down justice, or if we define down goodness so that we're not all complicit, I think I would make the argument that's just a way of running away from complicity and from the difficulties that it does in fact cause us. We have arrived, I believe, at an aporia, at a pathlessness, at a roadblock, or a place of complete ignorance, where these things come together and we don't know really what to say. Justice must be our goal, living the good life or the just life, but it is an unattainable and even undesirable goal in a certain sense. It calls to us, but we cannot fully heed this call. But neither can we flee the call. I'm saying that we can't extricate ourselves, this is a caveat, that we can't extricate ourselves from all complicity. I'm not saying that we can't reduce our complicity, and that more importantly, work for changing of those systems and structures that do wrong in which we are complicit. So we can't just say, oh, I'm always complicit. I'm just going to go buy a bigger SUV and I'm going to go, go get a chainsaw and start burning the rainforest or something. We really ought to try to lessen the complicity. In this situation, the idea of a completely just life becomes something of a fiction that may in fact motivate us to flee the recognition of complicity that might otherwise move us to better action. That is, when we think that we should and can be living a completely just life, we are more likely to partake of the mechanisms that we've talked about to deceive ourselves, that we are forgiven of our complicity. If we think that I ought to be living a life free of complicity, what's wrong with me? Well, I'd better seek some way to feel myself free of complicity, even though we can't really be free of complicity, so we're going to flee that. We're going to deceive ourselves. On the other hand, if we give up completely the idea of living a just life, we won't even come close to living a just life. From the point of view of those who take some kind of morality seriously, the complete abandonment of morality, of any idea of justice, is unacceptable, another form of fleeing. Now, moral relativists don't have this problem, but that's not where I'm coming from. What's left, then, is the difficult task of living in full view of our aporia. In between justice as an ideal and justice as an empty word, we recognize our complicity and do not hide from it, but somehow always keep it in view, troubling us, but not hounding us into isolation or into abandoning the difficulties that its call brings. That's kind of where my paper ends up. I don't know the way out of this dilemma, but I think we have to really live in this tension that we have between justice as an ideal and justice as an empty word. And that's it. Thanks very much.
And now Brad Woodworth, who is a PhD candidate in history at the University of Indiana.
Can you hear me?
Yes. I would prefer to sit here unless you need me to go up. I think, first of all, just to recapitulate what I understand Dave to be saying, at least in the first part of his paper, there's a huge amount of wrongdoing going on in the world. First. And second, it's virtually impossible for us to escape all hints of the weak complicity that are referred to in some of this wrongdoing at some level. That is, we are in the world, and so, in Mormon terms, are inextricably of the world, too. This results in a bit of a disconnect for most of us. We want to be able to say, wait a second, this really isn't fair. I don't want to be complicit in your wrongdoing. I want to be able to have the opportunity to have nothing to do with your wrongdoing. As a sort of moral approach on using your religious example, the atonement is supposed to be absolute, and this also is something that we as Christians would like to expect. That is, it's supposed to be able to be possible for us to be freed from all sin and guilt. I mean, the state of being responsible for and thus complicit in sin in the world. Dave's first answer is, well, that's just tough. The world is a complicated place, and it's made more complicated by us human beings, but we're here, so Where it's in happiness, there's nothing really we can do about it. In such a world, moral purity is impossible, something we should not even expect of Jesus, who also lived in the world. Now, I'm not going to comment really on original sin. Maybe that is the way to look. Maybe we should consider that first and foremost to try to get out of this dilemma. But rather, I think I'll just make a few comments on the notion of complicity in our complicity as we live in the world. Dave is certainly not abandoning the notion of moral complicity. In fact, he's in the end, he's accepting it and greeting it really. And we really have no choice to abandoning the notion. If we did, we might be only left with politics or with power relationships. So we could say ways at least problematizing the question of moral complicity. The one notion I want to bring here is that it seems to me our modern Western way of looking at our lives focuses so much on the role of the individual that we miss other possibilities for understanding how issues of guilt and complicity could be approached. Now, I'm not an anthropologist or a historian of early cultures, but it seems to me that most human beings, let's suppose this could be the case, that most human beings across the span of history have not actually seen their identity first and foremost as individuals, but members of one or another social group. The clan, for example, or a larger social caste, or part of an economic group. I think the history of the individual, and when I mean the individual, I don't mean the individual person, but the notion that I am first and foremost Bradley Davis Woodworth, that's really what's most important about my existence on the earth. This notion of the individual, I think, probably it depends on what area of the world we're talking about, what culture, but does not extend back nearly as far as we've been here on this planet, which is a long time. So if we can look at the notion that our identity might actually be part of a group, I think it has implications for ways we can look at guilt, issues of guilt and complicity. And I think Dave, at the end of the paper, starts to talk about this, where he talks about responsibility being the key. If you don't see your identity first and foremost as that of an individual but member of a group, then you're also going to share share responsibility in that group for actions that take place within the group. You're going to have a notion of collective responsibility. And I think I'll wrap up here in just a second. I think we can still see, even in recent history, some examples of how this notion of group responsibility has played out. I think it's been dead in Western European culture, which we've inherited, for probably 500 years. But in other, and I can't speak to non-Christian cultures, but I know that in other further Eastern, that is non-Western European, but Eastern Christian cultures, this notion of group responsibility for wrongdoing, still, even into the early 20th century, certainly in the 19th century, was still very strong. An example, to those who know my own historical interest, won't be surprised by this, but example I'd like to use is actually from peasant Russia. The Russian peasant lifestyle remained remarkably constant for hundreds and hundreds of years, at least from 12th century on. In many areas into the early 20th century, and the Russian peasants had really rather interesting ideas of complicity and guilt. And I'd just like to give you a couple of examples of those, showing how if we focus on the individual as opposed to the group, then there are totally different ways that we can understand the issues of complicity for wrongdoing. For example, in the Russian countryside, among the peasants. Peasants didn't see as moral or, let's say, legal violations actions which, according to the law, were actually wrongdoings. They were sins in a sense. Some of these were offending the honor of the rural police, public drunkenness, violation of rules of behavior in court, cutting down trees in state-owned forests, fraud with respect to state property, and on and on. On the other hand, actions which were seen by the authorities as wrongdoings, peasants often did not see as violations at all. For example, working on church holidays, that is vice versa. That is, the peasants did see as violations actions with which the state would have condemned. For example, working on church holidays, refusing to give alms to the poor, not participating in collective work or mutual aid in the village, the breaking of laws of the church, church fasts. It's just an example I wanted to give of how if we focus more on our responsibility within a group, which I think towards the end of the paper you start to speak about more, the problem of complicity and wrongdoing at least can become, if not mitigated, at least we can see that there are other ways of looking at it, and possibly there's not such a large contradiction or such a large problem as we would think if we focus on our own individual role within society, our own individual guilt or our own individual complicity in sin. That's all I wanted to say. Well, if you lived within that society, you would certainly not see it as relativism. Well, as long as we are living in the world, I think there are absolute standards within each culture.
But no absolute standard for all of mankind?
You can focus on collective responsibility. It's just that it's an absolute standard for what counts as collective responsibility. So it's not moral relativism. Just to focus on collective.
I think moral relativism would mean that you can freely take any, freely leave one system of looking at guilt or responsibility when it's convenient for you and go into another.
You're making a difference.
Well, I'll end my comments here.
We certainly thank David and Brad for their mind-stimulating presentations, and I know that they have provoked a lot of questions. And that's the next and final segment of our period here. And so we actually invite you to come forward to the mic to ask your questions. And if you care to, you might identify yourself, if you care to, not necessary, and then address whichever person you think should answer the question. Please come forward.
Doctrine of double effect would be. Have you thought about the relationship between the two? And the doctrine of double effect is that there is a significant moral difference between the intended consequences of what you do and the unintended consequences of what you do. And this is a doctrine that is popular in Catholic theology and ethics, and some people would say it's a correct doctrine. I don't think it is. But now, the criticism I have is that I think you've been too influenced or too indoctrinated by the philosophy department at BYU. They make you think that it's a good thing to end up with an aporia. It's not a good thing to end up with an aporia. In fact, it's a reductio ad absurdum of your premises, and so you should just reject one of your premises. And I think if you would just reject some of your premises, then you've got no problem here. And let me show you how to do this.
Okay.
There's an easy way of doing this. Suppose that consequentialism is correct. And then suppose also that about moral responsibility. Consequentialism doesn't say much about moral responsibility, but suppose in addition to consequentialism that if we are obligated to do something, then we're able to. In other words, ought implies can, the Kantian principle. Now, it seems to me that it follows from that, as long as you're just doing the best you can, you've looked at all the possibilities of what you can achieve, and you work towards achieving the best one, then you cannot be held morally accountable for any negative effects that occur, because you've brought about the best possibility. Let me give a concrete example, because I haven't said anything about complicity. So take the example of your car. We drive cars, and there's all these bad things that go on in making cars and in driving cars too. Now it might be that you see that it's bad that people aren't paid union wages. It's bad that we're deporting jobs. It's bad that we're destroying the environment. You see all of these things, and you realize that society would be better, things would be better if we eliminated these problems. And so you are working to do what, from your perspective, is going to eliminate these problems to the best of your ability. Now, in doing that, you can do it more effectively, you find, if you use a car, if you use the transportation. You can get to your protests in southern Utah or whatever. You're able to use the very thing. Now, if you do that on the consequentialist view, there's absolutely no problem in that. You're not held morally accountable for what the manufacturers of the cars are doing, because you're still doing the best thing you can do. You're still bringing about the best consequences. You realize that they're going to act that way. They're going to make mistakes. They're not going to be good consequentialists. So you being a good consequentialist is, you know, you get involved to some extent in doing things or in using products that may have been made by people who are not acting the way they should, but that doesn't make you morally responsible for what they do on the consequentialist view. So that's just one way, I think, of avoiding the aporia. And I'd just like to hear what your comments are.
Yeah, thanks for those comments. I haven't considered the relationship between complicity and the doctrine of double effect. So I hadn't heard of the doctrine of double effect before this morning. So we can, it's something to think about. Now, the second, reject one of my premises and not end up with an aporia. Yes, I like to end up in aporias. And that's the difference between you and me, Dennis. And because I think they're useful. And in general, I agree with Socrates, who thought you ought to end up in an aporia at some point, and then with the difficulty, move on from that, if you can. So, consequentialism. Let's take this example of you find you can get more effectively. Well, first of all, and this doesn't get to the heart of your objection, but I think we can see that, I'm driving my SUV, and then I see the wrongs, my complicity in that, and I say, oh, I'm going to drive my SUV to SUA meetings, and I'm going to drive my SUV to do good things, and I'm going to buy as little gasoline as I can. I'm going to trade in my SUV for a Geo Metro. And so we can say all of this, and so then, wow, you know, I have reduced, you know, I'm just using my car, I'm just polluting for things that will have good consequences, so I'm being a good consequentialist, is that right now, Dennis? In that area of my life, I think we can all see that none of us is going to be able to eliminate the complicity in all the areas of our lives, because it's not just our car. We burn electricity in our homes, and we buy clothes that are imported from the sweatshops in Asia, and we you see it builds up. And so, as much as I'm working to stop the oil companies driving around town, as I drive around town from meeting to meeting, I'm doing other things wrong. So I don't see it as being humanly possible to really be a consequentialist in all areas of our life in such a way that eliminates our complicity. In other words, as you said, to be doing all that we can to mitigate the complicity, and then we'll say, oh, culpability ceases. I don't think that's possible. But that doesn't really get to your objection, I don't think. And to really get to your objection, that's tricky. And I had some brief flash of how to get to that, and it was brilliant. You should have been there.
Was it inspiration?
We leave that up to a higher authority to adjudicate. I don't know how to answer that right now. I feel in my gut that that is not the correct view of when we're calculating things morally. I don't, but I can't tell you why. So we'll say. Okay, can I do that easily? Can I just say I reject consequentialism? Do I have to give reasons? Oh, well, I feel that if I were to reject it, I would have to give reasons, and I can't give you reasons right now. So for the moment, we'll let Dennis's objection stand, and although I think it's wrong. Okay, I guess Kim or Jean, one of them. Okay, here's a whatever.
I'm Kim McCall. I was drawn into the session. I would like your paper to deal with the hint you gave here about the moral deadening that comes from trying to live in the... I'm interested in moral experience rather than in calculus. And would like to see the paper try to deal with our moral experience of living in this world in a situation where you can't live... You can't get all the consequences you want. I'm not sure what, if anything, that has to do with the atonement, but there is a deadening that goes on, and the atonement, one of the things it's supposed to do in overcoming sin is help us aspire to something and believe in some possibilities that we may not see in ourselves all the time. At least that's how I read some of it. I want to give you, you know as much of this as I do, but Kant, I think Kant sees double effects, and he says what counts is the ones you mean, okay? And you got to be serious about looking at what the real consequences are going to be, but you can't just add up consequences. You have to ask, what is the person trying to accomplish with what they're trying to do? And it's possible to get real self-deceptive in that, and Kant acknowledges that too. But I think it's... If you want to take the moral perspective, the religious perspective, what counts is the development of our souls, and that's really, really different from the pollution of the earth. Now, it's not unrelated, but it's, you know, if you realize you're polluting the earth, then you're destroying your soul while you're doing it, to a certain extent, unless you've really worked on this. But what counts in life is development of the human soul and love and things like that, rather than some calculus based on consequences. Anyway, those are a few hints of things I'd like to see.
Talking about the atonement and moral experience, I also, I think I'm more interested in moral experience than in moral calculus, but it was easier to do moral calculus than to talk about moral experience. Yes, and so briefly, moral experience, and then the atonement and moral experience. And then I don't have much to say about your other point. Moral experience. Another thing that got me into this complicity, thinking about complicity, I lived for 6 months in Portland after I graduated from BYU in Portland, Oregon. And I got a job through a temp service working for an import company there on the 22nd floor of the Key Bank Tower in Portland. And it's called Nisho EY American Corporation. It's this huge Japanese company. And their Portland operation does all the importing for Nike, which is headquartered in a suburb of Portland. And, so I was there sorting custom documents coming from Vietnam and from Malaysia and Indonesia, and at the same time I'm reading in the papers about the injustices in Indonesia and in Malaysia and reading about the sweatshop conditions. There are injustices in the government and undemocratic things, and they're largely perpetuated by American money coming in from various corporations. And then there's sweatshops, which we've heard about, and Nike in the news. They're often terrible conditions. And we were paying like $3 for a pair of Air Jordans or to import it, or $10, and so obviously they weren't getting paid very much to stitch these together. And yet I went to work every day, and meanwhile I'm reading like Chomsky and all these people who are saying, this is terrible, and I'm thinking, I kept going to work every day and got my paycheck. So the atonement and moral experience. I definitely agree. That part that what we, when we want to talk about the atonement in good terms, we can say, yes, it should show us a way to freedom. It should show us a way to better possibilities in ourselves. And to that degree, and the life of Jesus, we're going to say, you know, that calls us to a better life. And that's much of what is so good about religion, is that it does call us to a better life. And so, yes, I think that can be used. We can use that to sharpen our the complicity that we feel, or to sharpen the motivation that we have to reform things, to change things, and to do better, and to change the social systems that we live in. And so to that extent, yes, that can reduce this moral deadening that we have. However, like as I pointed out, we can use the atonement to... We can say, well, I'm cleansed of the blood and sins of this generation, and we can use that as a way of deadening, furthering the moral deadening that we go through in the face of these wrongs that we... I guess, Dennis, my answer is that we can't... you know, as much of a Nike anti-Nike activist as you want to be, if you're still wearing sweatshop-made clothes... despite what you're doing, I mean, yes, I do reject consequentialism. Then you can't be, you know, driving your SUV to anti-Chevron protests and say I'm free of complicity because the consequences are going to be good. You're still enmeshed in that wrong. So yes, I reject consequentialism. Gene.
We have maybe 2 or 3 minutes. If anybody else would like to ask a question, why don't you raise your hand now, and that'll help us to time this. Well,
we may not.
Good luck.
I have to speak fast. Just a couple of things. It seems to me that one of the assumptions that could be used to avoid the aporia, or at least move beyond it productively, is to think about the atonement a little differently. As you talked about, it seemed to me you accept the evangelical and, I think, apostate Mormon concept of it as substitutionary, as having to do with justice rather than means providing. That is, the idea that the atonement is the power that Christ gives us, in fact, to live a more moral life, not simply to see it clearly, but to actually have the courage and power to live a more moral life. The other thing about consequentialism, I think, that needs to be read, we're all complicit in good, too, constantly, in unintended and intended ways. And it doesn't seem to me the answer to that is tallying or moral calculus, but to recognize that we live tragic lives. We have lives that are full of complicity and intended and unintended consequences, and the intention is to increase our intelligence and soul power so that we sort that out better as we live, both in terms of intelligence, understanding, seeing what the consequences are, avoiding them, but also having the courage to overcome our sinful nature and to actually live up to those understandings. My understanding of the atonement is precisely to give us that understanding and that power. And if we see it that way, I think it's a way through these difficulties. I even came up with a little saying that you can repeat. The atonement doesn't remove responsibility. It increases responsibility. Ability to respond.
Great. I agree with you that when we see the atonement as in terms of increasing our personal ability to do good rather than substituting for sin or justice or whatever, yes, that's good. And that does help us... That helps us out of our difficulty with the atonement. I was really interested just in using the atonement in discussing it in terms of our moral experience, that we do want to be forgiven for the complicity, and that can be deadening. But I agree, and I think that ties in some way with what Kim said, that it can sharpen our sense that we need to do better, and it can give us hope that we can do better. And the second point was...
I'm a philosopher.
I have a bad memory. I don't deal in second points either. Okay, next question.
Let me just say that we're not being recorded now, but there's nothing to stop us from staying here and having an interesting discussion, as long as the respondents are willing to stay with us.
We can stay for 5 minutes, and we've got to get out of the room. And I have to go run this.
We can speak without being recorded.
This is wonderful.
Yes, sir. You don't need to use a microphone now.
Okay. I'm going to wait till everybody's quiet. I have two questions, and they're kind of related. What is it in us that makes us comply or be complicit? What are the things that we value higher than righting wrongs or doing something about injustice? And kind of related to it, how do we overcome in little ways without becoming monks? How do we overcome placing these other things in our lives higher than seeking for justice for ourselves or other people? What is the way we can start repenting, I guess, is the way I've...
Ooh, boy. I don't know. I agree that we can't avoid complicity completely, but we're complicit in a lot of things that we could avoid being complicit in. Yeah. Avarice, I agree, yes.
Yeah, but there's more mixed thing. There's also duty, obligation, supporting.
He said other reasons.
How do we overcome? Is there a way to overcome?
That's complicated. Too complicated for philosophy. I have to go and run the conference. So thanks, and talk to you.